You are listening to Powder Radio. Brought to you by Powder Magazine. Welcome to Sponsored, brought to you by Powder Magazine. I'm your host, Mike Powell, and this week on the program, we have Canadian Olympian Matt Margetts on the program, and we're going to talk to Matt about his career, where it started out of Penticton, BC, and how it took him through the competition circuit and all the way to the Olympics. He performed on the highest stage and ended up 15th in the world at the Olympics in Sochi. We will talk to Matt about that. We'll talk to him about Seeking Nirvana, his project that he's working on with childhood friends, and all that's gone on in Matt's career. So sit back and we will talk to one of my favorite Canadians in the world, Matt Margetts.
Disappeared for a couple days, and when I got home back into service, we're like, the JP Memorial thing's going on this weekend, so we're going to be pretty busy partying and skiing and doing stuff for that, and then we're taking off on Monday, so we're going to be out of service for probably a week, so I just wanted to try and get it done as soon as we could. I didn't want to bail on you.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. And where are you heading out to next?
We're going to Breylarn.
What crew?
Seeking Nirvana.
Just the four?
Yeah, so me, Joe, Riley, and Mike, and then our filmer, Taylor, and probably our drone pilot, Dylan.
Nice, man. Well, I watched the new edit that you guys put out, and what you're doing is completely different than most ski things. You're actually telling a story, and you're doing it in a totally different style than what I've seen in the past, and I'm sure you're happy with how it's come out.
Yeah, it's been really, really well received, which is shocking. It's quite refreshing putting something out that there's been absolutely zero negative feedback on. It's been really cool.
If I were to look and see anybody trolling it, I would think if someone were going to put anything negative out, it would be that it is looking at some of these mainstream avant-garde type films that are a little bit different and using styles that are like that and putting in a ski movie. But you know what? That's what makes it different, separate. Your crew is perfect for that. And really, to me, it's like you're living the dream. You guys are just skiing powder, it looks like.
Yeah, that's pretty much been it. We've been chasing the snow, trying to ski as much pow as possible. And honestly, like, just skiing, not trying to do the gnarliest stuff, not trying to do crazy tricks, just trying to do some good, clean skiing and traveling a bit. It's been a really fun experience, especially for me. Like, those boys, they've all been filming for years, and I took a bunch of years off filming so that I could compete. And yeah, it's been a really nice change of pace for me, being able to ski in the pow and fall in the pow and not get hurt and hang with the boys. And yeah, it's been a good change of pace for sure.
In looking at your career from start to finish, there was an 8-year heavy competitive level of your career. You're at the top of your game in Canada and the world. You're in the top 20 people in the world. And that kept you a professional alive and sleeping in hotels and eating meals. You had to dirtbag a little bit to get to that point. Then you had 8 solid years of it. Now I won't say you're back to dirtbagging, but I'm sure it's getting back to what you love doing.
Oh, it's absolutely what I love doing. My whole ski career, if you can call it that, has been on the dirtbag side of things, just trying to slum it to try and make ends meet here and there so I can keep doing it. But I love it, and I want to be able to continue to do it as long as I can. It's pretty damn fun.
Yeah, and I mean, just seeing what you're doing now, it's what you always talked about back in your competition days, because even when you were a competitor, it seemed like in your early days, you still wanted to go out and ski powder and do a bunch of things. I mean, you were best at pipe for sure, but you were still focusing a lot of time on slope and skiing powder, and there was never 100% focus on pipe because real skiing was pulling you out of it.
Well, it was just a means to an end, right? I was at a time and a place where I thought that competing was the right thing for me to do, and the timing was right. You know, I hadn't peaked yet, so I just wanted to keep doing it until I got to a point where I was like, ready to move on and go to a different aspect of skiing again.
I feel like if you didn't compete, you wouldn't be doing what you are doing today. I would think those 8 years of competition established you as a player in the ski industry based on your skills, obviously, but your personality and everything you're able to market yourself with. And that allowed you to do Seeking Nirvana now, because like what you said, you're not doing anything groundbreaking in the skiing. You guys are just finding the best powder out there and putting some beautiful images to the camera.
We're just creating content, and it's living on the line.
It just looks like you guys are having fun, and you grew up with that crew, right?
Exactly. We were kind of all separated from our early days when we were in like freestyle clubs. Like I went down the half pipe route. Mike Hennetuck, surprisingly enough, was on the Canadian national team for moguls and filming for Poor Boys and was like their street guy at the time. And he decided to go the full film route and quit skiing bumps. And you can almost see his bump skiing in his pillow skiing. It's pretty impressive how smooth he is at ripping down pillows, no different than he was when he was ripping down bumps when he was a young buck. And Joe, he's been filming for a bunch of years, always been a really good jumper in the backcountry. And Riley, he took that filming route the earliest out of all of us and quit competing and started skiing big lines and charging. He's a beast. It's a good crew, man. It's really fun to work with the boys. We definitely butt heads on everything, as young males do when you're all stubborn and want your way. But it's kind of why our product comes out the way that it does, because we all see things differently and then come to a nice, happy medium at the end.
Is your filmer and drone guy part of that crew growing up too, or are they just random dudes that you pulled into your crew and they have to deal with your bullshit?
Our filmer, Taylor, he is very random. We hired him. He's out of Squamish, a little bit older fellow. He started his own production company called Art Barn. Yeah, we randomly stumbled upon him and he's fit right in. It's been a really easygoing relationship with him. And then Mike grew up with Dylan in Alberta and he's a phenomenal drone pilot. He's been absolutely killing it for us out there. And we've been fortunate enough to hire other people randomly throughout the year to try and spice things up a little bit, which has been good.
Nice. Well, for everybody who wants to see your latest edit, which I think dropped, what do you call those edits? Your latest movie, the short?
Yeah, we call them series.
Okay. Your latest series is just dropped a couple days ago.
Yeah.
It's called In the Sunlight.
No. Under the Moonlight.
I know, man. I know. Was it Penticton, BC, where you grew up?
Yeah, Penticton, BC. I was there since I was 5 years old.
And is that where that whole crew grew up, or which guys were from there?
So Joe and Riley are from Vernon, which is about an hour and a half north of Penticton. And then Mike is from Edmonton, Alberta.
Gotcha. And how did you even get into skiing when you were a kid?
Oh, boy. I moved to Penticton when I was 5 with my family.
From?
Victoria, from Vancouver Island. And I guess my parents flipped a coin on a map and it landed in Penticton and we jumped ship and went up there.
In America, we throw darts at a map, but in Canada, you guys flip coins on them.
I guess so. So yeah, landed in Penticton and parents asked me if I wanted to ski or play hockey. And I didn't really have any desire to get up super early and go play hockey. So I tried out skiing and I absolutely fell in love with it. And that's kind of where it all spawned.
And were they just dropping you off at the mountain on the weekends? Were they putting you into lessons? Or are they just teaching you themselves?
No, I just went and skied with my old man and his buddies. So we would go up every Saturday, Sunday, and I would ski with him and his good buddy Chester Baddish. And yeah, me trying to keep up with the good old boys.
What year is this too? Is this like 95-ish? You're a pretty young kid in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, this would have been probably 95. I started when I was like 6 or 7, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. And so skiers don't get into the terrain parks until what, 98?
Yeah, I don't really think there was much going on at Apex then. More side hits and cat tracks and natural stuff underneath the chair. And my old man, quite frankly, didn't have any money growing up, or I didn't have any money growing up, so we couldn't really afford to put me into any programs. And when I was about 13, he was like, all right, I think I've scrounged enough money to put you in a program this year. What do you want to do? You want to race or do you want to do freestyle? And I knew the kids from both sides because I would ski with them when they weren't in the clubs. And I went and tried out the race program for a day. And I was like, yeah, it's fun going fast. I don't really like the whole going through gates and stuff.
Right.
And then the next day I went and tried out jumping and going through the bumps and doing that with the freestyle club. And Miles Ricketts and Mark Abma were putting on like a free ride freestyle camp sort of thing early season at Apex that year.
Okay.
And I went and tried it out and I was in love. We had an air site at our mountain, which was just a nice big jump with a chopped landing. And yeah, every Saturday, Sunday, go up and try and huck my meat off the jump and try and figure out how to do tricks and catch up to all the other kids that were doing it. Good old days.
So you get into this program, your dad scrapes up a bunch of money. I don't know if you feel guilty about him spending it on you going in this program, but do you feel any pressure to do well, or is it just still having fun? And when do you start competing?
That year was the first year I started competing. And no, I never felt any pressure from my old man. He was just always stoked to be able to help out and give me the freedom to do the things that I wanted to do. And it was just always me putting pressure on myself. I always wanted to do well. I've always been that way. I put a lot of pressure on myself because I always want to do well. I always want to land. I always want to better myself. And yeah, it all started there. 13 years old, trying to learn how to ski bumps and hit a jump and do slope style contests. And it was crazy.
So that comes together and you're in high school at this point. Are you playing any other sports or is it just skiing?
I think in like middle school, I was doing your typical volleyball, basketball, but I was never really into sports other than skateboarding and surfing. Yeah, in the winter times, I would just ski full time. That was pretty much it.
And then, you know, when you finish high school, what do? Do you go get a job or do you decide you're going to dedicate your life to skiing? I don't know how serious you are about skiing at this point. I kind of have an idea because we worked together for a long time. But yeah. What happens after high school?
So it started about a grade 11. I had done a few contests, had done like junior nationals and Canada Winter Games and stuff. And a couple of the boys had went down to the US Open in Vail, Colorado. And I was like, all right, that's the next step. That's the next place that I want to go. So I went down to Vail, Colorado, and first run in qualifying, I fell on a rodeo 7 and blew my knee when I was 16 or 17 years old. And that was pretty much the start of my big ski career. So yeah, right at the beginning when it all started, I started having struggles then. So yeah, I came home. I emailed a surgeon, a little 17-year-old kid being like, hey, my sport's not even in the Olympics yet, but I'm going to train and go to the Olympics one day. You should try and get me in for surgery as soon as possible so that I can keep pursuing my dreams. It actually ended up working. I got in with Dr. JP McConkey, who was like Canada's best knee surgeon at the time.
If you're having a guy named McConkey operate on your knee, you're thinking this is just destiny.
Yeah, he did a great job. I never had any issues with that knee. Next year, went right into it. I worked all summer, and as soon as the snow started to fly, I dove right back into it, went to the US Open again, didn't do that well. And yeah, just kept trying to follow the circuit, trying to go to as many contests as I could. And one thing would lead to another. I'd have another opportunity come up where I would either get an invite to a contest or an invite to a shoot or something like that. It just became kind of like a networking thing where the more people you meet, the more opportunity that presents itself. It was pretty cool. It's very exponential how it all happens.
Well, I will say it's different for everybody, and not to blow smoke up your ass, but you're a very likable person.
Oh, thanks.
You know you are, and I think anybody that meets you, you put off a fun, positive vibe, except for before contests, but we'll talk about that a little bit later. You're always fun to be around, and everybody wants to see you do well. When you were with K2 at the end, there was nothing I wanted to see more than you up on a lot of podiums because you worked harder than anybody else. And like you said, you had a strategy, it seemed like, of going to every contest. And at the end of the year, when you could send results around and it was based on those contest points, you were always in the top 5, it seemed like, in Canada, even if you didn't podium that year, just because you made sure you were everywhere.
Yeah, I definitely tried to run around on the comp circuit as much as I could. I wanted to stand on a podium. I wanted to do well. I had a few, but definitely not as many as I would have hoped for in my competitive ski career. But amazing experience.
Yeah, and I feel like with your competitive ski career, when you were training and seeing what you're doing the day before a contest, everything was great. You're in a positive mood. And then contest day would come around, and when you'd walk up, it was almost like a different marg. I don't know if it kept going like this through the Olympics, but when I was around you, I wouldn't say like a twitch, but a little bit nervous and not the loosey-goosey dude that everybody knows, little more stressed out, and then getting mad at yourself and almost, I won't say hockey temper, but not stoked marg.
For sure. No, I definitely have a little bit of a twitch that happens when I get into that competitive mindset. I have an issue with things not working out or not going my way. And if it's something as simple as not doing a run that I wanted to do that I know that I can do, or falling when I know that I can just land, I just snap and I get super bummed on myself.
I mean, in your career, you probably skied, what, 200 contests?
Probably did. Since I was 16, or let's say 13, until 2 or 3 years ago, probably did.
And in every one of those contests, I'm sure that those feelings probably came to you before your run. Some runs you nail and you're fine, but I'm sure at every one of those contests, you were nailing your contest run before the contest every time.
Yeah.
But then contest day comes around.
I definitely did. I was one of those guys that could pull it off in practice or pull it off in qualifiers, and then try and go balls to the wall in finals and shit would hit the fan.
You're competing at an Olympic level, which is the highest level there is. Did you ever meet with sports psychologists and talk about why you weren't able to put everything together in the run in contest when you could always do it beforehand?
Yeah, I did. I talked with a few people and yeah, couldn't quite figure it out. That was the hard part about it, as I worked with a few different people. And I just couldn't get the answers I was looking for, and I couldn't get a solution.
Well, I had one for you, but it would get you kicked out of the contest. I think you need to start smoking a lot of weed, and that would have changed things for you.
I know. That's what everybody tells me, but I hate weed.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of different ways you can take it now.
Yeah, there sure is.
So, and it's legal in a lot of states in this country, and I don't know about in your country, but if it's not legal, it's there.
It's becoming quite legal in BC now. You can pretty much go and buy any weed product you want from a dispensary just around the corner.
Yeah, well, then that's legal enough. So in your career, you lived a dirtbag life, and you would take a trip to Tignes, France, and you wouldn't have a place to stay, but you'd call up and be like, look, man, if I can get enough money for a plane ticket, I can get there, and I'm going to spend 4 weeks in Europe, and I'm going to shoot here, 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 and here. And I'd be like, yeah, well, I can contribute to that plane ticket. I don't know where you're going to come up with the rest of your money, but it seemed like you always did. And how were you able to make traveling and things like that work for you? Because you definitely weren't pulling in $50,000 a year by any means from skiing.
No, unfortunately, I definitely was not. In the beginning, my dad helped me out a lot. He wanted to see me succeed and he would help me travel. But that was when I was living at home when I was young. So I would work in the off season and I would slum it pretty hard. I would network and make connections and make friends, and anywhere I would go, I would try and either sleep on people's couches or stay on floors or couches in hotel rooms, just anything to be able to continue to ski and to be able to continue to travel. And I still do it. It's fun. I love sleeping on couches at people's places. It's better than going and getting a hotel room yourself and sitting in a hotel room by yourself. I was just down in the Baja for shooting a Pacifico commercial. And I ended up meeting one of the girls that was at the shoot. And I was like, hey, I'm here for a couple extra days. Where do you live? What are you doing? Maybe I can come crash with you. And she's like, yeah, my boyfriend surfs. You can come crash on my couch. And they gave me the full tour, the full experience. I really got to enjoy the place and live the local life. And yeah, I still like doing that because, like I said, it's better than just sitting in a hotel room or sitting at a hotel bar and not really getting the full local treatment.
I totally agree with you, man. It sounds awesome. It sounds like what everybody should be doing, at least exploring the areas where they're at. And it sounds like you make sure you do that. In your travels, what's the craziest travel experience you've had? Because it sounds like you might have some that are crazier than others.
Oh boy. You want an R-rated version one or you want a PG-rated one?
I think I'd go with the R and then the PG.
All right. one of the funniest experiences that I ever had, and it's very fitting to what we were just talking about, is I was going to, I'm pretty sure it was a Dew Tour. So going to the Dew Tour at North Star Tahoe, and I just assumed that there was going to be like a shuttle or something from the airport to the resort. And when I got there, there was nothing. So I was sitting in the airport trying to get on Wi-Fi, trying to get a hold of somebody, couldn't get a hold of anybody, couldn't figure it out. And I was like, oh, last resort. Who am I going to talk to? All right, screw it. I'm going to call Tanner. So I call Tanner and he's like, yeah, I'll be there in a couple hours. I got my buddy Omar coming to pick me up. And I had not met Omar before, but I had definitely heard of him. So wait in the airport a couple hours. Tanner finally lands. Omar rolls up. We hop in a vehicle and they're like, what's going on? Like, what do you want? What do you want to go get some food? I was like, honestly, I don't care. I'm on your guys' program. Just stoked to get a ride and get a place to stay. And so we end up leaving the airport, probably don't even go 5 minutes, and we're walking into a strip club and it's middle of the day. So we go into the strip club and it's like a sushi bar strip club in Reno. It was great. Yeah, absolutely great. So end up staying there for a while, eating some sushi, having some drinks, getting some dances. One thing leads to another. We're getting drunk. It's later in the evening and they're like, all right, screw it. We've been drinking. So let's go park the car, get a place to stay in Reno for the night. So we get a hotel room to stay in Reno for the night. And Tanner's like, but I got to get up early because I have some NBC interview thing in the morning for the Dew Tour. So one thing leads to another. We end up bouncing around all night, going and gambling and going to another strip club. And I pretty much wake up face down in a gutter in this hotel room, feeling like a absolute bag of dicks. And I start looking for my wallet and my phone and my passport, and I can't find anything. And I start freaking out. I'm like, oh my God, what is going on? So I was like flipping the bed, opening drawers, trying to find all my shit. And I guess what had happened is we had brought girls back to the place. And I was so intoxicated that I guess I don't remember. And I have a strange suspicion that the girls that we brought back to the place ended up stealing my wallet. So I had no money, no credit cards, no ID, no nothing. Moving forward to being in the States for the next week and then going on like a month-long trip to Japan. So
no passport?
No, I did have my passport. I did have my phone. They just took my wallet, or I lost my wallet. I'm not really too sure what happened, unfortunately. So yeah, that morning, it's like 6 a.m. We're in the NBC place while Tanner's doing this interview, and I'm walking around from like office booth to office booth trying to use a phone to get a hold of my dad to be like, hey, can you help me? I need to order a new credit card to get it shipped down here before I go to Japan so that I can have money for this trip. So yeah, that was one of my bad slash crazy partying contest travel experiences with Tanner and Omar.
Well, that's a bad one. I remember one travel experience that I had with you where I think I was just trying to help you out. You were driving in town.
Oh yes, with Joe.
You wanted me to drop you off at the airport in your car and then take your car back to my house and hold it for a week and then pick you up. I said, no problem.
Joe and I were going to the Dumont Cup in Maine.
The car, it made it to the airport and completely broke down when you guys picked your bags up and left. And
yeah,
it was a miracle that we didn't get towed and you did get your car back and that all worked out. But it was just another day in the life of Matt Mark Getz's travel, it seemed like.
Oh, so many struggles. So many funny, awesome experiences, though, traveling with me. It's been a bumpy road for sure.
Because you're not like 2.5 hours early to the airport by any means, are you?
No, no, no. Why would you ever go?
No, I would never go 2.5 hours early.
Let's just hurry up and wait.
Yeah, that is. But you time it, so there's no downtime.
No, you just got to go.
Okay. And sometimes that works.
It works every time.
You have to have missed a flight because of that.
I missed a flight one time because I was sleeping at my gate and they changed the gate, and I got up to go check things out, and I had slept past it by like maybe 20 minutes, and I ran to the other gate and it was gone.
Yeah, that's not poor planning though. That's just stupidity, I believe.
No. That wasn't stupidity. That wasn't my own fault.
You fell asleep through it and you were at the airport already. You got yourself there.
But they changed the gate. I was ready. I was good to go. I was in Heathrow, London.
Well, yeah, they speak a different language there. I can understand where you kind of got messed up.
No, unfortunately not.
As a 16-year-old, when you blew your knee, your goal was telling that doctor that you were going to make the Olympic team.
Yeah.
You did make the Olympic team, and you sacrificed a lot in your life to be able to make the Olympics. I mean, you spent 8 years competing when you could have been maybe skiing powder, but you knew the path was going to eventually lead to skiing being in the Olympics, or your type of skiing being in the Olympics, and you were going to be a part of that. How did that feel when it finally all came together? Was it just overwhelming?
It was very overwhelming, but like we've been talking about, why would anything go smoothly for me? It's always been a struggle. I don't know why this is, but it just has been kind of the story of my life and my ski career. Let's drop into it because it's a big one.
All right, let's hear it.
The year had been going all right. I'd been skiing all right, not my best, but I was at a contest in Calgary. I had landed a run, got second or third or something. I made the podium, so I was one step closer to being able to make it to the Olympics. And we had one more qualifying contest in Park City, Utah. And I had landed my first run, but I wanted to do better. Mm-hmm. So what did I do? I went and tried something. I went and tried a dub 12, landed a little bit low, backseat, and slammed super hard. Hurt my leg. I went down to the infirmary and I had a big gash in my left calf and my left knee was pretty swollen and in some serious pain. So the next day I woke up and I couldn't walk and I flew home to go see a surgeon. And this is about a month out from the Olympics.
Oh, Jesus. And are you getting great care at this point because you're on the team and they're making sure everything's good? Okay.
Yes, getting really good care. So I go home. That day, I found out I have qualified for the Olympics. That day, I find out I have blown my knee and that I should not and probably won't be competing in the Olympics. And I was like, obviously an emotional fucking basket case.
Yeah.
Because I worked my ass off and worked super hard to get there. And of course, something like this had happened. So I asked my surgeon, what do you think? Like, Can I go? He's like, well, no, I don't think that that's a good idea at all. And I was like, well, I'm going to go. He's like, yeah, I had a feeling you were going to say that. So over the next 2 weeks, I worked my ass off with a physio and with a trainer. And I quit drinking. And I focused my ass off for 2 weeks in Canada. And I got a knee brace fitted up and I flew to France for our training camp pre-Olympics. And my knee brace didn't show up in time. So when I was in France, I was chilling for a couple days while everyone else was training. And my knee brace finally showed up and I slapped the thing on, went outside. And of course, it went from being beautiful weather to being complete shit. So I went and did a couple laps through the pipe and surprisingly my knee felt pretty good and it was nice to just kind of get a feel for it and see that I was able to still ski on it. The next day it cracked and it was Bluebird Day. I was able to ski kind of like nothing had happened, which was pretty cool. I was able to kind of do a run that I wanted to do for the Olympics.
Are you skiing confident?
No, very tentative because I was really scared and it hurt a lot.
Okay.
I was a little nervous of hurting it more for sure and was in a lot of pain. So we went to Munich, chilled out there for a couple days. Then we went to Sochi and chilled out there for a couple days. And this whole time I was just working with a physio and working with a trainer. And I was in the gym the whole time just trying to get strong, trying to keep my muscles activated, trying to get the swelling down so that my knee could work proper. And first day of training, beautiful day. The pipe was absolute garbage. One of the shittiest pipes we've skied in a long time because we've been so spoiled skiing perfect pipes.
Okay.
Then the next day, start getting into it. The pipe's a little bit better. I end up trying a trick and slamming and hurting my knee pretty bad. I wasn't able to put any pressure on it. I was hurting really bad. It sucked. Then the next day, I decided to take a full day off and a full day off training because I couldn't walk and I couldn't ski. And then the next day was contest day.
Oh,
and
geez.
It went from being like pretty much 30 degrees outside Canadian or Celsius to pissing rain. The whole Olympics was bluebird and hot and sunny and warm. And then the day of our event, it was just absolutely pissing rain.
Ugh.
So qualifying came around. First run, I landed a run, but it was not exactly the run that I wanted. I screwed up one hit, which then made for my second hit. I had to do something different.
Okay.
So I landed a run, but it wasn't exactly how I had planned. And then it started puking snow and nobody was getting the runs that they wanted to. And I tried and tried as hard as I could to hold speed and go as big as I could, but I was just too slow and I just wasn't able to go as big as I wanted to. And I ended up falling. And yeah, that was it.
You're 15th in the world that year, right?
I have no idea.
You placed 15th at the Olympics. It's a pretty impressive thing from a kid who couldn't get any real coaching until he was 12 years old. And really, it was all by a coin toss. Do you want to ski or do you want to play hockey? So
yeah,
it's a success story for sure. Could it have been bigger? Sure. But that's only part of your life. And now in life, you're doing something totally different, it seems like, other than the skiing that you're doing with Seek and Nirvana. But you're part of Wild Rumpus. And
yeah,
is that a big part of your life right now?
It is right now, yeah. So me and my friend Clayton Lanoue had this great idea to start a all-inclusive adult summer camp last year. Yeah, we pretty much wanted to just have a kids summer camp for all of our buddies. And we couldn't get anybody to sign up at first because nobody believed in us and what the heck we were doing. So I made a poster and put it online. And got some people with some big followings within Vancouver and BC to post it. And within a week of it being public online, I had over 1,000 submissions for camp. And the camp only has availability for 150 people.
Wow, that's amazing, man. So this will be year two?
This is year two. We're doing two weekends. We're doing Canada Day long weekend and Labor Day long weekend. And right now we're about 75% full for Canada Day. And my job right now is to deal with the marketing and organizing all of the people, making sure everyone's set with all the things that they need to know about camp and setting up all of the partnerships. So liquor partners, beer sponsors, trying to get as much product for people to come and get for free when they're at camp. And yeah, dude, it's been a pretty cool experience running an event like this.
Well, it seems like a dream for you because if there was something that you could do that would be amazing, would be a camp director with alcohol involved in the camp.
For sure.
You're going to make sure that everybody's having a great time, which is awesome.
Yeah.
And for those that didn't know, Canada Day is kind of like July 4th for us, but you celebrate Canada, right?
Yeah, on the 1st of July.
But Americans can go up there, right, for your camp?
Yes, they definitely can. It's 30% off right now.
Where would people find out about the Wild Rumpus?
Thewildrumpus.ca.
Okay, so that's what Mark Getz is up to now. Well, Matt, it has been nice catching up, and I want to thank you for your time and give my love to all the boys out there that are up there for the JP event.
I will do.
I will talk to you soon, man.
All right, sounds good. Thanks so much, pal. We'll talk to you soon.
So that was time with Matt Mark Getz, and part of the story we didn't get from Matt was he left the Olympics, went home, and went straight into surgery. About a month after his knee surgery, he started feeling some pain in his knee, and he got a massive infection in his knee. He had a home pick line for about 6 months, almost lost his leg. Everything came back perfect for Matt. His knees both worked great, and you can see him skiing and seeking Nirvana. So crazy Olympic story for Matt, but all worked out well in the end. And next Monday on thepowellmovement.com, we have Ian McIntosh on the program, and Ian is a force in the Big Mountains, and his interview is amazing, so I highly recommend that you tune into that. As always, if you have any show feedback for me, you can reach me at mike@thepowellmovement.com or PowellMovement1 on Twitter. On behalf of Powder Radio, I want to thank you for tuning in, and I will talk to you next week.